Hi, and welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name's Ted McIntyre, and this show is for the week of February 28th, 2021. Today, we're pleased to be joined by the State Director for the Climate Exchange, Mr. Tim Cronin. How are you doing, Tim?
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Good to have you. So, Tim, the backdrop for our conversation is the following. The state of Massachusetts has embarked again on legislation. There are the governor has put up a roadmap, which is an aspirational document as to where he thinks the state ought to go by the year 2030. There is a bill, an honest-to-God legislative bill called the Roadmap Bill, which is in debate back and forth between the governor and the legislature like a volleyball, right? We hope that that gets passed. But the crux of the issue is that the implementation of these ideas, these big things, is the implementation of the things that we have to do in order to reduce our carbon footprint by the year 2030 goes way beyond these two individual bills and calls for other actions. And one particular thing has been, how do you get the money to pay for all the things you want to do, and how are you going to spend the money? So we, in a recent show we put up, we talked a little bit about how we might raise some of the money, which would be through closing loopholes on people bringing fossil fuels into the state, right? So we can raise money that way. And another way is to use financial mechanisms like bonding, if they're called out to be specifically dedicated to global warming amelioration issues, right? But so that's fine, Tim, we can talk about that. But I think the real question is, what are the benefits? What are you going to do with the money once you've got it in hand? So tell me, is that a summary of where we stand and what we should be talking about tonight? Or is what do you think?
Yeah, I think that's a phenomenal summary. And if folks, you know, have any other questions, they can always go on to, you know, greenfuturenowma.org or the last podcast. So we talked a lot about that. But yeah, I mean, the thing that is, I think, the most important is, what are we spending the money on? And I'll start, before even going into that a little bit, is say that there is a lot of climate legislation that we need to pass in the state. And, you know, the roadmap bill, which hopefully by the time this comes out is passed, is an important step in saying, here are our targets for 2030 and 2050. And you know, we need to get to these and all these intermediate targets by those dates in order to meet our climate goals. So that says that important part. There's other legislation we need to pass to be able to get us to 100% renewable energy, ensure that the state is meeting all its obligations relating to environmental justice, and so many other important pieces of legislation. And I think you're right in saying we need to fund that. And so what this bill does, the Green Future Act does, it doesn't say here is what the money has to be put towards. That's what a lot of these other discussions are part of, and this other bills, or you know, this other discussion happening in the administration through the Climate and Clean Energy Plan. You know, it helps to define where we go, and these things will change. You know, what we need or what we're going to invest in 5 years from now is going to be different from 10 years and 15 years and 20 years. And it's important that we're flexible, that we allow policymakers some degree of flexibility in deciding how to put those different pieces together while still making sure they're reducing emissions. And so that's where this bill really comes down, is it has a few important big buckets where the money has to go and ensures it's being spent in the right way. You know, for example, in environmental justice neighborhoods and on environmental justice populations, but doesn't put too many more restrictions on it besides that.
Mm-hmm. And so we're trying to find a balance between prescription and pragmatism, that as you go down the line, you find new ways. So big buckets is an interesting way to put it, right? How the money would be spent.
Yeah. And it's really we have the target. We need to make sure that the guardrails are there and we make sure the money is there and it's spent on the right thing. And that's exactly it. And broadly, what the Green Future Act spends in is three big buckets. One is this statewide green infrastructure, you know, the big things like expanding, public transit, which obviously reduces emissions compared to transportation, or electric vehicle use, either through, you know, electrifying buses at school buses or through regional transit agencies, you know, through additional ways of reducing heating costs and allowing for energy efficiency and, you know, renewable heating for renters and homeowners as well, even to, you know, reducing the amount of fossil fuels that we use in expanding offshore wind and solar and other, you know, battery storage technology. Like all of these big things that happen across the state, that is kind of what we're spending it through, is the Green Infrastructure Fund. Mm-hmm. And it's a fund that can be used, and it's run by the governor and a number of key agencies. It includes representation from small businesses, from environmental justice communities, from regional planning agencies, from a number of external stakeholders as well, who all collectively decide on how that money needs to be spent, what the investment principles are going to be. And that's an important part. That's more than 50% of the funding and how money is spent in this bill.
The money we're talking about, we may, just to be clear, we're talking about something like $10 billion over the next decade or so. It's roughly $1 billion a year, give or take a couple hundred million, right, is what you would have available to invest in these shiny electric buses and improved housing stuff, right? Yeah.
Yeah, that's exactly it. And on the statewide Green Infrastructure Fund, between 2023 and 2030, and of course, it goes beyond that as well. You know, climate change is estimating that we're going to have about $5.7 billion between bonding and, you know, closing the polluter loophole, which we talked about last episode, to be able to spend on that, which is important. I mean, is it all the money we need? Probably not. I mean, the climate crisis is a big thing, but it does put a significant chunk of money towards things that we don't have any money for right now, or generally don't have enough money for.
The first bucket.
Yeah, the second bucket is local green investments. I think anyone across the state, anyone working in climate policy or green investments in the state will recognize is that not all cities and towns are created equal. You know, communities like Brookline and Newton and Cambridge, you know, have a lot more resources than others, you know, gateway cities or even communities like where I'm from in Weymouth, to be able to put towards achieving net zero goals or other things along those lines. And they need investments too, you know, and then they would receive some from this bill. But we also need to make sure communities like North Attleboro or Springfield or Worcester or Lowell or Weymouth are receiving funds as well. And so what this bill attempts to do is, you know, over the course of up until 2030, would put about $2.4 billion into local green investments for across the state. You know, think of it like the tide that lifts all boats. It helps you know, every community be able to invest in things like electrifying your school bus fleets, or creating local microgrids or community shared solar, or even things along the lines of allowing for nature-based solutions that not only sequester carbon, but also protect against some of the damage that communities are going to face from climate change. And one top level here that's important to note is that both these local green investments and the statewide green infrastructure fund that I just talked about, 60% of the money has to be spent on environmental justice populations, on the individuals who are on the front line of the climate crisis and who have historically borne the brunt of economic and environmental inequities over the course of hundreds of years.
And that's an important thing to note, right? I mean, what jumps to mind, I mean, that the neighborhoods in Boston and many of the gateway cities should be serviced with electric buses, like first thing, right? So there's your local aid, right? And I can imagine there are more rural places out in the western part of the state that could heavily benefit from aid. And as you say, sort of this natural, what was the phrase you used about the natural solutions for capturing, you know, protecting the town. So that's very, and I guess on top of that, just to go back to the point, is that this money is intended for these purposes, but it's not like granular in its definition of how things are going to, that's all going to be figured out later on as people recognize what the right thing to do with the money. But you got the money, you can get, people can get their hands on the money to do the right thing if they need to, right?
Yeah, and specifically with the local green investments too, the thing that we heard a lot over the course of our developing this legislation was that not all communities have a sustainability manager. Not all communities have the, you know, this big staff to be able to compete for these competitive grants to you know, put forward a seawall or do a microgrid or so forth. And so what we did is we made sure that this was a formula similar to how state aid for education works, where communities will receive the money automatically without having to go through this fancy application process and be able to spend it on the things that they need to spend it on. And of course, there's oversight. There's a requirement that it has to be spent on green investments, and that definition is continuously updated through, you know, the state from EEA. But it leaves a considerable amount of decision making in the hands of local councils and local communities to decide on what they need to spend it on.
Interesting. And tell me, the money that you've mentioned, the money flowing back, 60% of the money flowing back to environmental justice communities, which is almost like becomes a buzzword, right? But the is that like individual payments to households to counter costs, or is it something else?
Yeah, we talked last episode about the green dividends, which is individual payments to households, primarily those individuals in the bottom 40% of income in the state. This is different in that, so all this money is going to be, there's a portion of it that is going to be evenly divided among all communities, obviously by population. Bigger populations get more money, and the smaller ones get less. Then on top of that is another bucket of money, within that local green investments, and that money is just going to environmental justice communities. And so the environmental justice communities will receive more money than the average community. Right. So,
okay. To be protected because of the historic injustice. Yeah. We've got now these identified where the tranche of money is going to come from. We've got this very nice system of balancing the targeting of that money without being too prescriptive about how it's going to get spent. Tell me what do you expect what do you anticipate the benefits to the state of Massachusetts to be for having gone through this process? What do we get for the effort?
There's a lot of top line benefits that I'll go into different areas, but I'll say a few of them. One is creating good local jobs. Our climate change is really excited in the coming month to be able to release a job study based off what we did in Washington State, but specifically for Massachusetts. And we can show the amount of jobs that can be spent, that can be created in the state from different investments. And so knowing that we're going to get about $10 billion by 2030 from this bill, we can say that there will be at least 80,000 green jobs created in Massachusetts, or jobs created in Massachusetts. Most of those green, some of those from knock-on effects too, from saving money in communities.
But so when you say job creation, do you mean jobs installing the wind turbines? Do you mean specifically jobs that are connected to retrofitting houses as part of the infrastructure? Right. That's the kind of. So is it a range? Tell me, is it? Do you anticipate in the kinds of jobs? I know this is a projection, right? So, mm-hmm. but there's certainly construction jobs, right, which have a skill level. There are entry level jobs that people can earn a living doing the right thing. Both of those are included in that kind of calculation, right? Of 80,000 jobs.
Yeah, and once we have the actual numbers, I'd be very excited to tell you and the listeners about it as well, and people could check it out too. Based off what I've seen as well, about a third of those jobs are actually created by savings that go back into the economy and create jobs across it, small businesses and so forth. But most of those jobs are, you're right, going to be created in the clean energy and energy efficiency sector, areas that Massachusetts excels in creating jobs in. Think of, again, installers and construction workers on everything from building retrofits to offshore wind to onshore wind to solar. There's also maintenance jobs associated with that. There's also other entry-level jobs or long-term jobs associated with either municipal government or some of these larger grid infrastructure that needs to be maintained and continually updated. So
I get all excited as a son of New Bedford, Massachusetts, with the big wind turbine facility down there. I mean, that's going to be a lot of jobs, right?
And the other thing too that to know as well is that this bill actually has a little bit of a dedicated money towards green workforce development, and it's labor led. It's covered by things like project labor agreements and prevailing wage laws to make sure that these are good paying jobs and generally union jobs, but also that the thing is when you're investing $10 billion into jobs. Jobs happen, but they don't automatically happen. It doesn't automatically mean that everyone in the state or the people who are best positioned to it have the training and workforce skills to be able to get into those jobs. And so this bill also does include a pretty significant bucket of money to be able to fund job training and so forth, to get individuals, especially, you know, people who are currently or formerly incarcerated or mm-hmm. other folks from environmental justice or vulnerable communities, to be able to get into those jobs, you know, through training and, you know, useful applications of that money. So
you used an interesting term that I think is worth just being conscious of, a project labor agreement, which sounds kind of like a union agreement, but probably not specifically. Tell me more about what a project labor agreement is, and should we have our ears perked up for that as we hear it in the future? Is that something that will be useful here?
Yeah. Project labor agreements are generally most large infrastructure. Think of big buildings or highways or other things like that are already covered by project labor agreements. We reaffirm that within this bill. And what they are is they're agreements between the people who are constructing it, whether it's a company or contract or a business, and the workers who are going to be there to make sure that it's that the job itself, that the folks who are working on it are union workers, or at the very least are being paid prevailing wages and enough money to be able to feed their family and, you know, have a living wage from. So
That's great. So just to recap, what we've got here is the Green Future Act, which is a mechanism for generating the money that is needed to achieve our climate goals that are enumerated in other bills, right? This is sort of a implementation kind of thing. You say, here's where we can get the money. Here are the big chunks of the ways that we ought to spend it, right? On statewide green infrastructure, on EJ communities, on local aid, and there's going to be clear benefits from it. And so it seems like a win-win-win, something that we should be supporting, right? The Green Future Act from Representative Bill Driscoll, right?
Yeah. And I mean, we've been working with a wide variety of individuals, from environmental justice representatives to members of labor, to municipal officials, and of course, advocates and activists from across the state, and economists too, on how to make sure this bill can achieve these things we need to and be implemented in a way that, like you said, complements other bills, other mm-hmm. legislation, other efforts that are happening. And I think this is also a really important kind of thing to be discussing right now, because we need to be thinking about how to create long-term jobs, both because, there's a general need to fight structural unemployment in the wake of the COVID-19 economic recession and the kind of current job losses that we're witnessing over this last year, while also needing to reduce emissions and prepare for climate change. And so I think this is a really important conversation that's happening right now. I think as we're taping this, there's about, I think, 30 or so lawmakers who have co-sponsored. I'm sure a lot more will as well in the next coming weeks. And I'd highly encourage folks, if they are interested and inspired by this bill, go to greenfuturenowma.org and or do both. Reach out to your state representative or state senator and say, hey, co-sponsor this bill, because it's important to me, it's important to the future, and it's important to Massachusetts.
Okay. Everyone should know that there is yet another opportunity to be on a virtual lobbying day. So it's scheduled for Wednesday, March 4th. I'm looking at my calendar. Thursday, March 4th. It's going to be through the course of the afternoon. The organizers will set up Zoom calls with your representative, and you and several other of your local constituents can talk to your state rep and ask him or her to support this kind of stuff. It's a great opportunity. We'll put a link in the show notes as to how you can get to that. So Tim, we should put it down there. I will put up the links to Green Futures Now and the climate exchange and this bill, and how people can sign up for the virtual lobbying day on the blog at massclimateaction.org/blog. If you have questions, please send us suggestions or comments to podcast@massclimateaction.net. Of course, you're listening to this show now on your smartphone using one of the modern podcast distribution apps. Please tell all your friends about the Climate Minute and have them listen to us on there. Modern podcast distribution app. We want to thank our good friend D.R. Tucker for his continuing research support. We want to close where we always close, by saying that we recognize the necessity of personal accountability for our actions, that we accept responsibility for building a durable future, and that we believe it's our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out. And because of those things, we have to insist that the United States transform its energy sector over the next decade under a just and equitable plan that uses regulation, investment, and a price on carbon to safeguard our future. So, Tim, thank you so much for your insight and wisdom here tonight. It's been very interesting.
Yeah, thank you. And thank you for all the work you and M can do, and highly encourage folks to go to that lobby day as well.
That's great. That's great. Anyway, we'll see you all soon. Bye-bye.
Very cool.